Lure the Temptress. It's Revolution Software's first game. On Amigas, everything Amiga. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Amigos. I'm John.
I'm Pixels at Dawn.
And welcome to Amigos. That's right, folks. For the very first time ever, we have a non-American host of Amigos. We need to talk right off the bat about an unfortunate incident that's occurred this past week. Unfortunately, Brent and Aaron's mom passed away after a long illness. So our thoughts are with Aaron at this time. He did want the show to go on, so we are doing this show in his honor and of course to remember his mom. So, Pix, you got to tell me about your history with the Amigos. Where did it all begin?
Long, long ago. I don't think you even had a video format when I first started watching the Amigos. That would be, 8 years ago?
Yeah, 2015 was the last time we didn't have a video.
it was all way back then. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite start listening as early as a certain Mr. Folds, but it was certainly getting on towards that direction. I can't remember how I ended up coming across the podcast, but I was quite lucky to find it as early as I did. So
and then I just
got more and more involved.
So. Yeah, I was going to say you started out helping us out with various activities. And would you say that your job, your current position with Amiga Addict, is somewhat tangentially related to the Amigos podcast?
It absolutely is. Yeah, I mean, the only reason that I got involved was because Jonah, our editor, is part of the Amigos community, and saw what I'd written on the website, and tapped me up and said, He saw the opportunity and he dove right in, as all good entrepreneurs do.
So. That's right. Well, that's fantastic. And of course, now you far surpassed the Amigos in fame and grandeur. So we'll talk more about Amiga Addict a little bit later on the show. But, you know, before we dive into Lure of the Temptress, I'd like to hear about just your history with the Amiga in general. Tell me about how you got involved with this wacky computer.
So, I mean, my first computer was the Spectrum, mm-hmm. Which is why I'm quite happy with our Sinclair when that comes on.
Yeah.
I got most of my machines. I got as a result of jealousy of my best friend. So he had a Spectrum before I did, and then I ended up getting a Spectrum, and then he switched over to Amiga. And so did I. I got my Amiga 600 around 93,
okay.
Which for a lot of people is quite late on in the Amiga cycle, as it were. I had that for a couple of years, and then I sold it and got a 1200. And then I had that until about 97, 98,
mm-hmm.
At which point I was getting towards going to university to do some coding, and I thought, I'm going to need a PC to do this. So that was the end of my Amiga tale. So I was actually with it quite late, because a lot of people say, I got rid of my Amiga in 92, 93. It's like, no, that was when I started.
Well, the 600...
things were just getting going.
I think the 600 came out in 93, or was it 92 or 93? Yeah, 93. So you were on board with the latest and greatest, sort of, with the 600.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Could not afford 1200 at that point.
Did you ever run into games where you had to use a numpad?
Not very much, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the stuff I was playing back then was puzzle games and platform games and things like that, which don't need a numpad.
Yeah.
You're really looking for things like, you know, Railroad Tycoon and Flight Sims and things like that, where they really need the numpad. There was occasional sort of PD stuff where it goes, right, now press number pad 7, and they go, well, I can't. And I remember looking around for like are there ways I can remap these keys and use other keys on the keyboard to do it? But there didn't seem to be any way of doing that. So you were just stuck. So I do have memories of that. And of course, back in those days, we didn't have wonderful things like a WHD load and things like that, or even a hard drive, to be quite honest.
Right.
So there was a lot more in the way of compatibility problems. So sometimes you'd try and play an old game that was designed for the 500 and it wouldn't work. It just wouldn't be happy at all with ECS or with more memory or whatever. So it was a lot more temperamental then. Whereas now you can I can run pretty much anything on my 600, right, which definitely wasn't the case back in the day.
Yeah, that's true. Now, what led you to get back into the retro scene, or did you never really leave the retro scene?
I never really left. I mean, I got a PC, as I say, to go to university, but I almost immediately started emulating other things. I was using the very early versions of UAE. As it was the useless Amiga emulator back then. That was right. What it actually stood for. It was DOS then. It wasn't Windows. It didn't really work very well, but occasionally you could get things sort of working and there'd be lag and things wouldn't quite, and things would glitch out all over the place. So I followed that emulation all the way through and equally Spectrum emulation as well. So I was into the retro scene from early on, but that was before really retro became big on the internet. I didn't have the internet back then.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more of a personal crusade.
A personal quest for emulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't even imagine trying to figure out UAE without a bunch of online resources to help me out.
Yeah, it was hard work.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of hard work picks, let's talk about Lure of the Tempest. All right. Lure of the Tempest. Now, Pix, I plugged you for this position. One, because you're my good buddy. Two, because you're good on the stick. But three, because you sort of wrote the book. And by the book, I mean the article on Revolution Software and Lure of the Temptress. So I knew that you had some quality background information about this game. You want to give us a quick primer on Revolution Software and the background of the development of Lure of the Temptress?
Sure, can do. So Revolution Software are well known for point-and-click adventure games, of which this is one of them. They were formed in Hull in the north of England back in 1990. The founders were Charles Cecil. I had to look up how to pronounce this. Noireen Carmody, nice Irish name. Tony Warriner and David Sykes. So they were the founders. Charles himself started off on one of the first home computer publishers, Arctic Software. He was writing adventures even then. This was back on the ZX81. Mm. So he was writing some of the first like text adventures. There was one called Adventure B, which he wrote in 1981. So that was back when things like Colossal Cave were coming out and all those sorts of things. So he then moved on to US Gold, which we hear a bit about, certainly in Sinclair. And he also headed up development at Activision for a bit as well. And all these things tied into them being able to build a company that could do the things that Revolution ended up doing.
Probably a combination of his programming acumen through those companies, plus the amount of financial cushion that he might have built up over the years, moving from bigger to company to bigger company.
Probably help.
Mm-hmm.
So he spoke to Tony Warriner, who was working at Activision at the time, and who suggested David Sykes as someone who was a great coder that they wanted to work with. And then Noireen came in as she was working as a general manager at Sierra. So that's another big adventure company that was involved. They ended up getting married, and they're still married now. So There was a little bit of a family affair going on there as well. So they got together, they started looking at what they wanted to do, and obviously this was a company focused on point and click adventure games, which was obviously Sierra had been doing a lot of stuff. A lot of this Charles had seen when he was publishing those games for Activision. And he'd played a lot of those things, so he knew kind of what was big and what was going to be coming up in the industry. But he wanted to go and form his own company and get coding again and get back to his roots, as it were. The name Revolution comes from one of his colleagues, Roger Large, who said he had all sorts of the revolutionary ideas. Well,
Sir, good name.
fairly simple, but also they were going to come on a revolving floppy disk, so it was kind of a bit of a double entendre almost
Okay,
for the
interesting.
name. And then the logo, so the logo of Revolution we saw right at the start of the video there. It's kind of like it's the knights riding into the forefront of the logo, like sort of Templar knights or something like that, coming out of a sunset,
It always
and
reminds me
that.
of it always reminds me of a game like Lords of Midnight on the Spectrum when I see that.
Definitely. And that comes from when they were first forming the company, they all sat down to watch the 1981, I think, film Excalibur. So he said in fact, I'll read exactly what he said here. He says, "The inspiration for the Revolution logo came from the opening scene to the film Excalibur, in which the horses gallop through the woods and then stop, panting with steaming breath, and the knights jump off to attempt to pull a sword from the stone." And that was kind of the vision that they wanted to get for their company, really. He did say they changed it at one point to this purple logo and then realized they'd made a terrible mistake and then changed it back, and then it's been that way for the last like 30 years.
Well,
So
is they did the smart thing and realized that it was bad and changed it back. If only more companies would do that.
exactly. So they only made three games on the Amiga. They made this one that we're going to look at today. That after this one, so this was the debut game, which is quite impressive, as we'll see. Their second game was Beneath a Steel Sky, which is obviously a huge game. We covered it on Amigos back in September 2019, a little while ago now. That's obviously a fairly legendary title. And then they also did a port of King's Quest VI because it wasn't going to come out on the Amiga. And Charles decided it was going to, so
Wow. So
they got the rights to support it.
that was probably a labor of love, right? Because he just cared so much about the
So yeah,
platform. Yeah, wonderful.
I think so. And then, of course, after the Amiga, they became super famous for making the Broken Sword games, which they're still making to this day. In fact, there's a new one in production right now, as I understand it. So, their base now is in York in the north of England, which is coincidentally also the base of Amiga Addict magazine.
Oh, wonderful.
And in fact, Jonah used to work just down the road from the offices. Their offices are on one of the most famous streets in York called the Shambles. It's like an ancient historical street with all the sort of leaning in buildings and all the close together buildings. And if you walk down there and you look up a bit as you get towards one of the corners, you can see that Revolution logo we saw. It's like a sort of cast iron thing sticking out of the wall, and that's where their offices are.
They need to rename that street. That's no good. It's
Revolution
like,
Street.
no, yeah, they need, I mean, it's like naming your street Pigsty Lane. What are they doing? The Shambles? Come on.
But I think it's called that because that's where all the I think it's where all the like abattoirs and stuff were, and it's where all the blood from the slaughtered pigs and stuff ran down the street. So I guess it's kind of
I
appropriate.
guess so. I guess so. Let's go into a little bit about what is going on in this game. So this is a the game gives you a pretty good description of the backstory, both in the text of the documents and also the text, the opening text of the game. In this game, you get a bunch of text right up front And it's also the only time that music is featured in this game. Yes, it's another one of these where there is absolutely no background music except in the opening and closing scenes with the text. Essentially, what's happened is you live in a town called Turnvale. And Turnvale has been invaded by these orc kind of guys. They're called Skorl. Not squirrel, like the animal, but squirrel, like, I don't know what. I always think about, do they have chewing tobacco in England?
I believe so, yeah.
There's a brand of chewing tobacco called Skoal, S-K-O-A-L. Have you heard of this before?
I haven't. We have a lager called Skoal.
Okay.
S-K-O-L.
Okay. Well, I always think...
I think it's from Europe somewhere.
Yeah, I always think about the chewing tobacco when I read this word squirrel. But anyway, these guys are like the servants of Selena. And Selena is the titular temptress of the box art here. I believe that I remember reading, and you can back me up on this, they'd completed the game and there was no temptress and there was no lure, and somebody came to them and said, hey, the name of your game is going to be Lure of the Temptress. Did you read that?
So they're pretty much done, because that basically, what they wanted to make was a village, an interactive village where things happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did that. And then the publisher said, right, this is going to be called Lure of the Temptress. And Charles is like, well, there's no luring and there's no temptress. So we're going to have to go and try and make this fit. In fact, in the write-up, it talks about an enchantress, which is apparently also the temptress. Originally, it was going to be called Vengeance. I guess that got chucked out the window as soon as the people that paid the money decided that it was going to be.
I will say the Lure of the Temptress is a more evocative name than Vengeance. And anytime that you can put an attractive lady on a box cover, you're gonna do better than not. So
yeah.
and so anyway, you play the character called Dermot. Yeah. And this is now, I want to ask you another question related to your area. Is Dermot a common name where you come from?
So not spelt the way it is in the game. Mm-hmm. Cause it's almost like Dermot, isn't it? Like in the game, but yes. Dermot is an Irish name, I think.
I know that the guy from Father Ted, I think his name was Dermot, right? Yep.
Dermot Monaghan.
But you didn't. There weren't a lot of guys rolling around your primary school with the name Dermot.
No. I think I've only witnessed them through media. So there was like Dermot O'Leary was quite a well-known television presenter in the UK for quite some years. I don't really know what he's doing now, but. So it's not an unknown name to me, but it's certainly not the most common.
Yeah. So anyway, you play this guy, Dermot, and you do what you do in a point-and-click adventure game. You sort of amble around, picking up objects, manipulating the environment, talking to people, and dying a whole lot. This game is not like the Sierra Adventures. You know, I'm always sort of interested in looking at the timeline of graphical adventures because it is something that you can chart kind of systematically over the years. You start out with very simple text-based adventures and then you add maybe a graphical window at the top and then you get a rudimentary full motion graphic with a parser a la King's Quest. And then slowly that sort of morphs into the Scum engine on the LucasArts side. But then you get all of these different branching pathways in these European developers, where in including this particular engine, which I guess is called, although Virtual Theater doesn't really describe the scripting software that's used in this. I don't know that they named that exactly. The Virtual Theater, do you have that name? Sorry.
So the engine was called Virtual Theater. The scripting language was called Script.
Ah, okay.
They weren't inventive with it. But I think it's quite interesting because this game has quite it has a very sort of a bare bones interface. It's more about the graphics and having a full screen without any interface in there, which was kind of common at the time, because around about that time you also had Loom by LucasArts, mm-hmm. which didn't really have any interface on it. You had Future Wars by Delphine, who made mm-hmm. Flashback and all those kinds of games. And again, that worked very similar to this, in that there was no interface, and you right click and you get a menu and you do something with the menu.
Yeah.
So I guess it was kind of the done thing at that point in time, kind of thing.
Right. So tell me about the first time that you played Lure of the Temptress. Had you played Lure of the Temptress before this week?
I played it when I did the article for the magazine. That was the first time that I played it.
Okay. So tell me about some of your first impressions.
It felt a little bit clunky to me when it first started, because I didn't really understand how the interface worked or what I was supposed to do. And it's one of those games where you start off in a prison cell, which can work or not work in equal proportions.
Yeah.
Because certainly, basically what happens is you're in a prison cell, and occasionally the door will open and one of these Skrull will come through. And if you walk up to me, he'll just punch you in the face and then go away again. So you can repeatedly just get punched in the face, which is not always the best way to get into a game.
And being punched in the face is the equivalent of dying in this game. So when you're punched in the face, you get an option to either restore or restart. So you will see, and it sort of is used in a lot of different scenarios. Anytime that you're interacting with the Skrull, the bad outcome is always getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
I want to say...
It's not too difficult to make progress at the start, because there's not much to interact with. So you can very quickly figure out to do a thing and to get out of that room. It's not too bad.
I'll tell you. First of all, right now, guys, spoiler warning. I'm going to give away some of the early puzzles in Lure of the Temptress. This is a game that I played for an hour without being able to figure out the first puzzle. Because in this game, what you have to do is it depends on how you describe the first puzzle, because you start out in the cell. Okay. The Skrull opens the door every once in a while, and he says, you can talk to him about various things, and then he'll leave. Once you play for a while, you realize that you can manipulate the torch in your room. The only thing you can do with your torch is accidentally drop it on your bed. So you do that, the bed becomes engulfed in flames, and the Skrull runs in, and he's like, "Oh!" And you're like, "Okay, I'm getting out of here." And so when I got out of there, I was like, "Yes, solved that puzzle. It's time to go have some fun." No, it's not. Because you walk through a couple rooms, you start doing other stuff, but that Skrull is going to come in and hit you in the face after about a minute, no matter what you do. And so I went into like the third or fourth room where you meet Rat Pouch, your faithful companion. And I freed Rat Pouch, and I was like, "All right, let's hit the raid." Well, the Skrull would come in there every single time and punch me in the face. And I was like, "Well, what do you do? Well, the answer is you lock the door when you leave the room, your burning bedroom. However, you don't have a key, and if you try and unlock the door, it says that you need a key. And so for some reason in my mind, or maybe it doesn't say that, and then just in my mind, that was what it said. But it never crossed my mind that you'd be able to lock a door without having a key. And so because of that, like I said, I played for an hour without being able to progress past essentially the first zone. So that gave you no problem at all, right? You zoomed right by it.
I had a couple of problems when I first played it, but I very quickly learned that if I didn't want that Skrull to be coming after me, I was going to have to do something about it. So I just put the bolt down on the door, and that was it.
One of the things that that sort of gave me pause, and I think one of the problems that I have with this game, is that this game is, there are a lot of things that you have to do within a specific time sequence. So this is not a game that will freeze time until you do what you need to do. And in fact, that's the whole point of the game. The whole point of them creating this this virtual theater is that you live in this living, breathing world where characters are always moving around and doing things independently, which is cool. It's cool as a concept, but anytime, this is a lot like my problem with a lot of puzzle games. Anytime that you introduce a time limit to a puzzle game, well, really, this is even worse, because a time limit to a puzzle game just says you have to solve this puzzle in this amount of time. Whenever you're solving puzzles in a game like Lure of the Temptress, you have to think about two different variables. You have to think, do I have the right items, and am I using the right items in the right combination? Or do I have everything correct and I'm just not here in the right time, or I'm waiting for something to happen in the world so this thing can happen? And not knowing that, having that uncertainty, to me, is not fun. Because I don't want to have to wait around for things to click into place to go. To me, that sounds like life. It sounds like you're always waiting around, you know, to do what you want to do. When I play a video game, I want to get right in there and do the stuff on a time scale that makes sense for me. What do you think, Pix? Did you find the fact that you're living in this living, breathing world and the puzzles and the kind of interactions that you need to have to happen on the game's time scale? Did you find that pleasant or infuriating?
It can be infuriating. I think part of the problem with the virtual theater engine, because it's, I didn't realize until I was reading up about it, it really is all going on in the background. Because obviously, in a traditional point and click adventure, you'll basically, when you go from screen to screen, effectively you're teleporting between locations.
Mm-hmm.
That screen will reset almost every time you go into it. Whereas the way the virtual theater engine works is it's constantly simulating everything all the time on all the screens, but only displaying graphics for the one that you're on. So actually those people are actually walking, or certainly the bits that represent them are walking around in the background all the time. The problem that gives you is you go, right, I need to go and speak to the blacksmith. He's not in his blacksmith's place. Where has he gone? He's off on a walk. He doesn't care. He'll be back later. And it's even worse because you use your faithful sidekick Rat Pouch you have to use him to solve puzzles. And where is he when you need him? Nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of find him or bring him back. What is great, and we'll probably come to in a bit more detail with Rat Pouch, is he's not just a person you go do this. He's like programmable, basically. He's like he's got rudimentary AI attached to him. You can say, I want you to go to this location, pick up this item, push this thing, go to this next location, and then come back here. And he'll just go off and do it all for you,
mm-hmm.
Which is very unusual for a game like this. Usually you have to do everything. But yeah, so like right at the start, there's like a secret passage you have to open, but you're too weak because you've been stuck in a prison cell. So you can go to this room, push these bricks over here, and then come back. And you could just stand where you are and he would go and do it. As it turns out, you just follow him and you can see it all happening. But it's this thing where you're saying, do this, and then do this, and then do this. It's being able to give a stream of instructions to basically an NPC is quite unique, and something you see in like modern RPGs like Dragon Age and things like that, where you can instruct your AI companions, but it's quite unique, and something you only really see in this game.
Yeah, and again, this is, I mean, it is very cool, and it's something that's very unique. I can't think of another point and click adventure where you're able to give that fine degree of control over somebody who's just following you around. But that adds another layer of complexity to all of the puzzles, because not only is it, do I have the right thing and am I combining it with the right stuff? Am I here in the right time, or am I here in the wrong time? Or is this something that Rat Pouch is supposed to be involved with in some way that I haven't figured out yet? So
yep.
There's lots of different levels of complexity. And again, I mean, At this point in 1992, I mean, we are sort of post Monkey Island 2. You know, we are post a lot of the King's Quest games. We're post a lot of the Police Quest games. At this point in the genre, people, developers were looking for ways to move the genre forward. And so, you know, I've got to give them credit. The all of the stuff with Rat Pouch, all the stuff with Virtual Theater, it moves the genre forward. Now, you'll notice that after this game, there weren't a whole lot of point-and-click adventures that followed suit with the virtual theater or with the programmable sidekick. And one does wonder if it's because those ideas might not lead to the most smooth gameplay experience and the most pleasurable time for the player himself. So, was this game sort of a dead end in some ways? I would say in some ways, yes, but of course, this was the debut of the virtual theater, a concept that Revolution would go on to use in games that are beyond the point-and-click genre. So it ended up being very useful for them, and for being the first game to come out of the studio, it's very impressive. I thought.
I think it says a lot that they toned back a lot of the characters wandering around and all those parts of virtual theater in Beneath a Steel Sky. They still had things where you could have effects on the environment and have effects on the state of each location or each scene, but you weren't chasing people around all the time. I think I said in my article it says a lot that a lot of the time in Lure of the Temptress, your characters are going along saying, "Hey, stranger, wait," because you're chasing people to try and get them to do things. That's the first thing he says to everyone. It's like, "Hey, wait, come back."
Exactly. Now, this game unfortunately also suffers from a lot of the defects that the point and click adventures tend to have, including there's a ton of pixel hunting in this game. There are places where it's literally one or two pixels will be an item. There's a knife on top of a barrel very early on that took me forever to find. And this game doesn't do what the Sierra Adventures do, where it changes the icon or it gives you some sort of indication of where something is. You know, and I think that you have to look at these games on sort of a continuum where you have player focused. I don't want to say lighthearted because in a lot of ways this is a lighthearted game. There's a lot of humor in it, but it's not goofy like Monkey Island is. It's not a comedy game.
It kind of sits halfway in between LucasArts and Sierra, I think. So, because Charles said he wanted to he said, use the word juxtapose, so I'm going to use that as well because you'll never hear that on Amigos again. He wanted to juxtapose a serious story with sort of wacky, ludicrous kind of comedy kind of stuff. And so he wrote the serious part of the story, and Dave Cummins basically applied the funny stick to it and made it actually amusing.
But
So,
you get a game like Monkey Island that's very, very forgiving to the player. There's no way to die, there's no way to get stuck. And there's a lot of sort of quality of life improvements that the LucasArts series sort of iteratively made that kind of came. I mean, Monkey Island 2 is probably the pinnacle of all that stuff within this generation. In this game, it has some of the stuff. You know, it does have context sensitive menus when you right click on things. You don't have to choose from a million different prompts that don't work or that aren't effective. It pretty much only gives you things that you can use. So that's great. That's great. I like the way that you get the whole screen. There's no HUD that's in your way. I found all of that stuff to be pretty intuitive. Now, I was never I didn't get far enough to where you're really dealing a lot with the inventory. How did you find the inventory system in this game?
It's not too bad. I mean, you kind of have to right click on Dermot and go status to find out what he's carrying. And so it's almost you can see the transition from Charles's earlier work in text adventures and graphic adventures quite clearly in this game. So it's almost like typing in inventory to see your inventory. And every room you go into, you can right click and go look, and it will give you a full almost fairy tale description of each room, which is great to read because it really sort of accentuates the storytelling aspect of it. But equally, it also has things like, so if you think in a text adventure, sometimes you'll go up to a cupboard and you'll say, you'll see the cupboard and you have to go open cupboard, and then it'll reveal something that you can find. So like in the, one of the first puzzles in the game is you find a prisoner and you have to give him some water. So you find a bottle and you find a barrel full of water. Great. There's a tap on the front of the barrel. Brilliant. I just need to use the bottle with the tap, which doesn't work, because what you have to do is you have to look at the barrel, and then it says, oh, there's a tap on the front here, and then suddenly you can interact with the tap, yeah, which you could see the whole time.
It's that kind of stuff that drives me insane. It drives me insane.
I got quite frustrated with that.
Now you
and other things like you can open a sack with a knife, and there, unless you look at the sack, you don't find the thing that was inside the sack. So, and that comes directly from text adventures.
Sure.
So you can kind of see how it's happened and how that transition has occurred. But gameplay wise, it's a little bit frustrating. Or it's not. I guess it's not too bad once you know that's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you'll be hitting your head against a brick wall trying to figure out how to just turn a tap on or whatever.
It does make me wonder if this game was kind of scripted out in a text adventure type style. I mean, obviously this game was scripted out on paper with text, so the answer to that question is yes. But but I mean, that whole mindset of look at the barrel. Now you can see the tap on the barrel. Now you can interact with the tap. Yeah, just seems like by 92, we should have gotten past that. We should be past that era of point-and-click adventures.
I think some... So things like Monkey Island and Monkey Island 2 and things like that, I think they were kind of being developed in parallel with this.
Sure,
So Revolution couldn't get the benefit of the Scum Engine, for example, of seeing how that works and things like that. So it's another one of these ones where you see, it's almost like your VHS and Betamax kind of thing, isn't it? You see people developing things in parallel, and it's like, which one wins kind of thing.
Yeah.
It kind of works out that way.
You know, on the other side of it, this game does give you a full, you know, quasi sort of realistic village to explore. You go all over in this game. You know, you explore the entire village. There are lots of different screens that you can interact with. I think I read there's something like 60 screens where you can go and do different things.
Right, yeah.
You know, that part of the game, there is a lot of game here. I was just pulling this playthrough off of YouTube. It looks like if you do everything right, almost as fast as you can, it takes you about 2.5 hours to get through the game. So obviously it's going to take you exponentially longer to do it as you work your way through with trial and error. So there's definitely plenty of game here. Now, you are still a pretty active point-and-click adventure player, I believe. Did you play the Tim Schafer games that came out a couple years ago?
I've played a few of those. I actually backed the new one, which the name is eluding me right now, but I'm sure chat probably knows the one that where he came back saying, I'm gonna do a new adventure game. So I played a bit of that. That was good fun. I backed a few on Kickstarter. There was one sort of Cthulhu based one, or sort of comedy Cthulhu based one.
Oh, you're
right. Jumbleweed Park is one of I played on stream actually as well. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, I still enjoy classic point and click adventure games.
What do you think, you know, in terms of the way that the genre has evolved past this, what are some of the major differences that you see playing something like Thimbleweed Park versus Lure of the Temptress?
A lot of it is just quality of life things and stuff like that. Something that there's a period of point-and-click adventure games before you get to the point where you can just double-click on the edge of the screen and the character will walk there, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And things being designed in a way where you're not going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards between locations all the time, because that's frustrating for the players. Like, I've been here 17 times, but I've got to go over to the other side of the world to pick up this item to come back. So there's some game design in there as well to to carry you through rather than having you going to and from all the time. But there's certainly, I think there's a sweet spot with adventure games, which comes in kind of like the mid to late 90s, where a lot of the technology was in there. And that's why I think we see a lot of modern, in inverted commas, point-and-click adventure games basically being quite a kind of retro adventure games, because the interface and the technology behind it all works. You just want to stick a story in it and stick some graphics over the top of it and have it just work. I've never had a problem with having lots of verbs and things like that. So something that's actually frustrated me a little with some of the modern ones is they've almost simplified it too much. And you just go and you click on things, and then and you don't have to decide what you want to do with an item. It just it's a kind of like do or don't do,
right?
It kind of move and do or don't do.
I agree with you. I've played a little bit of some newer games, and it really removes a lot of the player agency. The games almost just become more of like the sort of interactive novel or whatever, where you're clicking through scenes, and you know you do get puzzles now and again, but it's not quite the same as negotiating through dialogue trees and then deciding, you know, like, do I want to use this on this? No, well, you don't have to decide. Just click on the thing. It knows what you want to do. And
I mean, it doesn't. And don't get me wrong, I don't want 100 different verbs which are all ever so slightly different, because that's irritating in itself. I don't want to have to know whether I need to push or to prod or or whatever it is. It's got to be distinct. So find turn or pick up or talk to and things like that. As long as they're distinct, that's fine. But you want to have some level of figuring out what kind of thing you want your character to do, because it's a little bit like you're almost like Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, where you're almost telling the story of what your player does.
Right.
If your story in D&D was I went to a place and did a thing, then it wouldn't be very interesting for anyone involved. Mm-hmm. you want to say I went here and then I carefully opened up this chest and looked inside and did this kind of thing. So
yeah,
that's what the agency is, I think.
The best games are the ones that even reward your wrong choices. Like if you try and open the lever with the spoon, or you try and open the jar with the spoon, and you're treated to an animation of you trying to wrench it off and it doesn't work, you get a laugh out of it, it doesn't work. Hey, it's okay, I tried it, it gave me the choice. And again, we go back to the LucasArts games for just being great at stuff like that. For me, the biggest change in the modern point-and-click adventures is there's no need to artificially pad the length of games. I think that was a constant concern for games that came out in the early 90s, was that they were scared that magazine reviewers would beat it in a weekend and they would give it a poor review because it was quote-unquote too easy. And that's why you end up with all of the maze sequences or the extended pickup and delivery sequences, like you said, where you're constantly revisiting the same place over and over again. So I'm glad that we've gone beyond there. But there is, like you said, there's definitely a lot of charm with these originals. This game... go ahead, Pix.
This definitely feels like the tech demo for what they were going to do later on. It's still a fun game, so tech demo might be a little bit cruel, but you can definitely see they were putting all the stuff in they wanted to try,
right?
And then they took some of that stuff away or simplified it a bit and smoothed it off for their later games on the Amiga and on PC later on as well.
Yeah. Now we should talk a little bit about the ending of the game. The game does end with you, this game, actually, I can't believe we forgot to talk about this too. There's actually a combat mechanic in this game. This is another part of the game that I didn't get far enough into to see, but I remember reading in the documentation that there are various strikes that you can perform with weapons. The icon will change depending on what kind of strike you want to make. I'm not sure how many combat sequences there are throughout the game, but you definitely defeat a huge skull chieftain at the end of the game who is opposed to wearing clothing. And so there is combat. Did you experience any of that during your playthrough, Pix?
I didn't, because I think you have to get quite a way through the game to get to those bits, and I think there's not many of them either. I think it's one of these things where it's like, here's all the instruction on how to do combat, which you'll use once.
Right.
That kind of thing.
You do confront Selena at the end of the game, who morphs into a giant scorpion.
What you want to say.
Yeah. And then you dispatch her, and you get some denouement with the end of the story. There are tons and tons of characters in this game that you beat, of course, because it's a point and click adventure game. And so the ending does sort of tie the loose ends together. But there are no credit sequence. There's no ending kind of graphic other than just a couple screens of text. So I wouldn't be surprised if very few people actually managed to finish this one off. This one seems like a real tough one.
I think it probably is. I think for the reasons you mentioned around there being these layers of things, the puzzles with Rat Pouch and with all these people wandering around, it makes it a lot harder to... Whereas it's nice because it's a world, and it feels more like a world than your traditional, even like a LucasArts adventure, where it just feels like you're walking on the front of a stage almost.
Yeah.
But that comes with its own issues around being able to see, sort of dissect the game in your head and go, I've done these things, so it must be this third thing or anything like that.
Right. This game did perform well with the reviews. It was reviewed in almost every contemporary Amiga magazine of the time. The highest magazine rating came from Amiga Format, who reviewed it in July of 92. They gave it a 92. The lowest one came from Amiga Magazine, which they reviewed it a year later in February 93. They gave it a 7 out of 10. I always like to look at Amiga Joker. Amiga Joker loved it. 81%. That might as well be 100.
81 from Amiga Joker.
Yeah.
I was going to say, that's a hell of a lot, doesn't it?
most of the reviews were in the high 80s and 90s. The average magazine rating is provided by the wonderful site Limit Amiga, 88%. Did we get any Discord reviews on this one, Pix?
We certainly did. So Alien Breeder says, as a big adventure game fan, I remember seeing Lure of the Tempest in the magazines and wanting to get my hands on it. The graphics looked amazing, and the story seemed very interesting. And as Revolution's future adventures, it did not disappoint. It may not have been as deep as Beneath a Steel Sky or as engaging as the Broken Sword series, but it's still a great adventure. It's been over 30 years since I played it, so it's tough to remember details, but I do remember loving the game. I give it 875 top bananas out of 1,000.
That's a lot of top bananas.
Too many top bananas. Just for a little bit of trivia on this game, you mentioned the village is called Turnvale. That was the original name of, well, sort of the holding name for Revolution before they decided not to call themselves Revolution. So it's a reference back to that. And also, the game nearly didn't happen. So I don't know whether you know about the whole Robert Maxwell saga and Mirrorsoft, but in that period of time, there was a publisher called Mirrorsoft. Their CEO was Robert Maxwell. And they were quite happily going to publish all of Revolution's games. But then he was discovered floating next to his yacht.
Oh, my gosh.
It's one of these mysteries where we don't know whether he did that to himself. Some people say he was taken out by the Israeli Secret Service or potentially the Russians.
Wow!
It's never been clear, but it transpired he'd been embezzling from the pension fund or something along those lines. So Mirrorsoft went down. It nearly took. This company with it nearly took Sensible Software with it as well, who were going to publish their games as well. So possibly this wouldn't have happened, but it got picked up by Virgin Interactive and saved. So yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of games that weren't so lucky, but some of the big Amiga things, like, as I say, Sensible Software, would be a completely different landscape if they'd gone the way of the dodo.
Sort of interesting. This game was released on DOS, Amiga, the ST, all at the same time in 92. But the game looks like it was published by Konami on DOS. We're looking at the DOS version of the box up here. It'd be interesting to know how they got involved with Konami in the DOS field.
It's interesting because I think Charles wasn't that keen on putting it on DOS. Mm-hmm. So what he said to me was Virgin asked him to put it onto PC, and he thought it was a crazy idea because he says at the time your sort of user level PC was mostly monochrome with not very good audio or it had CGA with four colors
right
for the resolution. He said he bought himself a top spec 386 which he played flight simulators on and adventures, but because that was right the top spec, they couldn't pitch it at that at all. So he thought it was a crazy idea, but they obviously made it work because the DOS version was very popular, I think. So
yeah. Well, there's a lot of caveats in the manual that talk about, like, if you don't have a mouse because you're on a DOS machine, here's how you can control the player and all that stuff. So another piece of trivia that I found is there's a bug in this game that prevents you from completing it. Now, I don't know if this is for the ST, the Amiga, or DOS, or all of them, but it says to fix this, you have to choose the restart game option as soon as the game begins. If you don't do this, then at least one vital item, the tinderbox, will not appear. Man.
Oh, no.
You want to talk about something that makes you never want to play video games again. Spend 1,000 hours playing a game that has a bug in it that makes it impossible to finish. So
that at the time there was point and click adventure games could be a bit like that. You'd have point and click adventure games where if you didn't pick up an item at a certain point, you then transitioned and you could never get back to the item.
You'd get stuck.
But you'd get to like the last hour of the game and go, right, you need to need this item to do this thing, but you didn't pick it up.
Yeah.
So start again.
Sierra was the absolute worst when it came to that stuff. I think it was King's Quest. I don't know if it was 6 or 7 that I got. It was the first one that was available for me on CD-ROM, because when we got our CD-ROM on our computer, I was so excited. But yeah, that happened to me, and I was like, never again. I'm done. I'm done with Sierra. Yeah. Well, anyway, Pix, any final thoughts on Lure of the Tempters?
I did have a look on eBay. Mm-hmm. It's actually surprisingly rare on eBay, which surprised me. You can pick it up for about £30 or £40. There is some joker trying to sell it for £600, but you know there's always a joker trying to sell things for £600. So it's available. Amiga games are expensive to pick up these days, boxed.
Yeah.
So I think that's not a terrible price. I'd probably like to be a bit cheaper myself, but if you really, really want it, then you can definitely get it.
All right. Well, let's move right along.
Welcome to Retro Rewind. I'm your host, British Jones. Whether you enter the Amiga, Commodore 64, or Tiger Floral Print speed suits, Retro Rewind has all you need from the friendly hosers of the Great White North. Looking to upgrade your Amiga? Check out the Amiga OS 3.2.2 Kickstart ROM for just $18. Or maybe you need a C64 or C128 diagnostic harness. Grab one while they're hot. Don't miss our bestsellers like the 1541 Transit Card for just $1. Or the incredible Amiga Coin Cell Battery Adapter. Shop now at Retro Rewind Limited and bring your classic computers back to life. Retro Rewind Limited. Frank's the man.
Amiga News. Campbell Trail.
All right, Pix. It's time to talk about this week's Amiga News. Now, if you're watching live on YouTube, you may notice that there's a blank screen here. Trust me, that was all by design.
Of course.
So let's kick things off here with the Kickstart floor plan for the community room. Now, were you at Kickstart last year, Pix?
I absolutely was, yeah.
Okay, so tell me about what goes on over in the community room.
Yeah, so last year, the Kickstart was spread over 2 rooms. This year, it's over 4, I think, because we got an extra floor. But the traders room and the community room are opposite each other and basically staying the same way. The community room is where the user groups get together It's not like an exhibition or anything like that. It's kind of meant to be like just a normal user group meet, but on a larger scale. So many of the user groups have their own tables. They bring along their own kits and they do what you'd normally do at a user group meet. You show off what you've got and you chat to people from other places and you get to see what they brought. So that's happening this year as well. My user group has a table there. West Midlands Media Group, you can see on the diagram there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also building in some extra stuff into that room this year. There was a bit of an empty gap at the one end, and then filling that with a little exhibition, I think, now from it says a Leicester Retro Museum.
Yeah,
that's coming along.
Yeah.
So
I'm very interested about Rob Smith's floppy disk cleaning station.
Yeah, well, he had his backup station last year.
Uh-huh.
But I'm guessing he's doing, and I know, I'm not sure whether that's going to be the totality of Rob Smith's contributions, because he hinted to me that he got some amazing new thing this year, but he wasn't going to tell me what it was. So,
is this a special machine? Does he have a machine that cleans floppies?
I think so. I think that'll be what it is.
He
showed me at Amiga Island. He had one of Neil's Mister machines that they make at the cave, but he had an extra unit underneath with like a double disk drive in there, so you could put your actual Amiga discs in and load them up properly using his drawbridge stuff. So he's a clever guy. He does amazing things with this stuff.
That sounds great. I am super looking forward to Kickstart. You know, it seems like every week there's more and more awesome stuff that comes out. Of course, if you want to see Pix and I there, plus Tony Warner from Revolution Software, he is one of the keynote speakers at the event. So plus, you know, tons of other people. Mike Daly is going to be there. Trevor Dickinson. Of course, Mr. Pleasance will be there. So you can check it out at amigashow.com. Get your tickets now. It's going down June 29th and 30th over at Meadow Lane Football Stadium in Nottingham. All right, Pix. Next up, we've got a new update for Grind. This is a first-person shooter for the Amiga 500 made with the Dread engine. Pix, what do you think the fascination is with making a functional Doom clone run on the Amiga?
I don't know. I think it comes from people wanting to play Doom back in the day and they couldn't on the Amiga. Obviously, there were Amiga versions and Amiga sort of equivalents.
Mm-hmm.
I think the nice thing with Grind is it's A, trying to work on basic like 500s and things like that. And it's being its own thing. It's not trying to just port a different FPS onto the Amiga. It's making its own FPS. I really like the updates on Grind, but I'm kind of getting to the point now where it's like, I really just want to play this now. Can you finish it?
Yeah.
Because, well, it does look really nice.
It does. Really, I mean, I'm watching this demo right here, and I mean, the way that the gun moves, the way that the barrel rotates, the way that the projectiles fly, plus you've got the moving nighttime graphics in the back. This is really going to be great when it's done. It doesn't look like there is any date, release date coming out, but
some point in the future.
Some point in the future, that's right. But we will keep talking about it because it is sort of neat to look at. All right, yeah. Coming up next, this is a game that I am very excited about. This is a port of Flying Shark. This is a game that I believe was originally an arcade game and is now being ported to the Amiga. It was originally ported in 88 by Firebird. As you can probably expect, it did not look quite as good as this. This looks fantastic. This is still coming along here. It looks like this is done by Magnus T, JMD, and John Sarkaris. Anyway.
He was also involved in Grind, that links that back through.
Fantastic.
It looks really nice. I've never been a big shoot 'em up guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think things like 1942 and stuff get a little bit closer to my wheelhouse in terms of shoot 'em up. So So this might be interesting, but I tend to be just terrible at them. I can't stay alive more than 5 minutes. So it does look great, and I think people who enjoy shmups will definitely enjoy this one, I think.
Absolutely. All right, coming up next, this is a new video from our friend Neil/RMC.
Indiana.
He has located a extremely rare prototype of the Lemmings arcade board. This is something that I knew existed, and apparently this is the only known prototype that exists in the whole universe. I watched this thing. The story is quite interesting. He talks to Mike Daly about the history of Lemmings and about how this arcade board just kind of showed up. The original Lemmings design team had nothing to do with the creation of the arcade machine, which was Data East. But funnily enough, they did incorporate some aspects of the arcade machine into Lemmings 2, such as the fast forward button, which I thought was interesting. Did you give this one a watch, Pix?
I definitely did. I find myself having less and less time to dig into Neil's stuff these days, but when this one popped up, it's like I have to watch this one, because we've heard the legend of the Lemmings arcade machine for many, many years now. I've spoken to Mike Daly about it in the past, so actually seeing it working or sort of working, there are some glitches and things in there, was fascinating. So I'm intrigued to see what Neil ends up doing with this. He talks a bit about it in the video, but it'll be interesting to see how it ends up in the end.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I feel like now that Neil has kind of proven that he can make these 3D printed bespoke arcade cabinets, he talks about, what if we did that with Lemmings? What if we made it in the shape of an umbrella? You know, what if they can do whatever they like? And of course, this is all thanks to Neil's connection with the other businesses there at the mill, the arcade business and the 3D printing. Do you recall the name of the group that does the Mr. Multisystem? I can't think of it.
I think that's Heber, isn't it? I think
Heber. That's right. Heber. Yeah.
It's on the box on the video, right?
Perfect. And so, you know, he's made all the right connections. This would be something that I would love to see and would definitely bring more people to the cave. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
Our final news story this week is, hey, guess what, guys? There's a Amiga magazine in town that's been going on for nearly 30 issues. Their latest issue just went to press, and we have the rare opportunity to talk to one of the head folks at that company that makes Amiga Addict happen. So, Pix, why don't you tell us just a little bit about the history of Amiga Addict, what you guys are trying to accomplish with this magazine, and what some of the things we can look forward to in the future are.
So, obviously, I'm the deputy editor of Amiga Addict magazine. We've been going at it since late 2020, where our good friend Ravi and our editor and publisher Jonah got together with their crazy madcap scheme to do a new print magazine after 14 years of there being nothing on the shelves. I got involved quite early on, and we've been non-stop ever since, really. Pretty much all of my free time that isn't spent podcasting with the Amigos, it's spent doing the magazine. In fact, we went to print today. I spent my lunch break doing final checks on it, and trying to do that and make notes for the episode in parallel. So it's a lot of work. The next issue is going to be we're celebrating the French Connection. Not the film, but we're looking at all of the amazing stuff that came from across the channel in France. So companies like Delphine, who made Another World and Flashback, companies like Lauriciel, games like North and South, lots of interesting games that come from French developers. I do a review of a game called, and I don't know how you pronounce it. It's either Extase or Ecstasy, depending on how you look at it, which is a very quirky, weird, almost art house French game that I kind of want people to know about. And there's a user guide in there, so you can actually figure out how to play it as well. But yeah, we've got a huge feature about all the French games and companies with interviews with some of the developers. I do a little feature on the Sony Vaio CD drive that you can connect into your Amiga and how I did that myself. It's a packed magazine, as always. It'll be out in a few weeks, so it'll go to the printers, it'll take a couple of weeks to come back, so it'll be sort of middle of May, I think. In fact, if I look on the last issue, just here, I will know directly. I guess that's the last issue, which has Scala on the front.
Mm-hmm.
And the date in question, if I can get the page up, 2nd of May. There you go.
All right. Fantastic.
That's when that should be turning up.
Wonderful.
But yeah, it's been going well.
Yeah.
Amos is included, Aaron, because, of course, Francois Lyonnais is indeed very much French.
From the big F.
I want to do a big full feature on Amos at some point, but it definitely is factored into our cover feature for this one as well. And we have our normal Amos tutorial. We're on like part 7 or 8 now. So yeah, there's lots of French programming in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Amiga Addict, longtime supporter and sponsor of Amigos. We really appreciate Pix, all the work that you do and Jonah does and Ravi and all the team for making this magazine the best, not only the best quality, but also the best selling English language Amiga magazine in the world. So congratulations. Congratulations.
Cheers.
All right. Coming up next week, Pix, guess what we're playing? I know you know because you're the chairman of the selection committee. We are playing Projectile. Projectile.
Yes.
What can you tell me about Projectile, Pix?
I know basically nothing about Projectile. The Amiga loves its future sports games.
Yes.
I think this is a future sports. Well, you can tell by the picture there. It's got a guy standing on a floating platform, garbed in armor, ready to punch someone. I think it's a sort of overhead, kind of Tron-y, kind of spinning disc kind of game, I think. I've never played it, so I don't really know.
All right. That sounds good to me. Listen, I'm always up for a good future sports title. So,
yeah.
As always, if you would like to support our show and you like what we do, head on over to patreon.com/AmigosPodcast. If you join us, you will get access to our rockin' Discord server and lots of other treats like a magnet at the end of the year. And you can really hobnob in person virtually with Pix and most of the people in the chat right now. So make sure you do that if you want to. Guys, thank you as always for listening. Thank you, Pix, for being here. And
no problem. And
Aaron, we are thinking about you this week. We will see you next time. Aaron will be back in the chair. And until then, adios.
Adios.
Amigos is made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Patreon supporters help choose the games we play, receive exclusive magnets, and get access to the Amigos Retro Gaming Discord server. Visit patreon.com/AmigosPodcast if you'd like to support the show and join our community.